Good morning. Great to see you. I want to wish a happy Mother's Day to all of you who are moms, grandmoms, great-grandmoms. It's a super special day. There are so many articles written about Mother's Day, and I have to confess to you that Billy and I made plans for sermons that did not include Mother's Day. I cannot believe Billy told me this morning I wasn't thinking about Mother's Day when we planned that as well. And of course, that would be par for the course for me, but that is super unusual for him. And he's always thinking about special days. And I usually think about special days when someone on that special day says, "Hey, did you know this is a special day?" And so this morning's sermon is not directly about mothers, but I wanted to start by talking about Mother's Day. And this story that I have in my hand is about the beginning of Mother's Day. And it starts by saying Mother's Day honors the best mother who ever lived, your mother. And I'm hoping you're sitting there thinking that's the case. I do not know how a mom could be better than my mom was. I do not know how a mom could have worked harder. I do not know how a mom could have sacrificed more. I do not know how a mom could teach spiritual things to her family more. I just don't know how a mom could be better for the purpose that God introduced moms into the world. And so I believe that I am honoring today my mom as the best mom who ever lived. And I'm hoping my children are honoring their mom as the best mom who ever lived. As we think about the sacrifices and the love that is shared among moms, Anna Jarvis is widely credited with making Mother's Day as a holiday an institution in America and even across the globe. The idea dates back, however, to the 1850s. When the Civil War was getting ready to begin, there were some mothers in West Virginia that organized into Mother's Day work clubs. Isn't that interesting? Mother's Day work clubs. Do you know anybody that works any harder than moms when they are doing what they need to do for the home? And then during the Civil War, these groups got together and they worked caring for wounded soldiers of both sides. Can you think of greater love being expressed during the Civil War for those Yankees to be helping the Confederates and the Confederates to be helping the Yankees? That's what those moms were doing during the war. And then after World War II, there were Mother's Friendship Day picnics in an effort to bring Union and Confederate loyalists together, urging them to promote peace. Julia Ward wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and she started a Mother's Peace Day. Around this time, many of the Mother's Day work club events were organized by her. After her death, this lady that started all of these things, Anna, she held the first Mother's Day observances in 1908 to honor this writer of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And then cities across the country began to accept and adopt it. And then in 1914, President Woodrow Wilson named the day Mother's Day, and it became a national holiday. Today, it is estimated that $23 billion will be spent honoring moms in one way or another. Of course, Hallmark made it a very special day as they started making Mother's Day cards, and some of you mothers, very special, will receive cards today. But the lady that started all of this, she did not want commercialization to come into Mother's Day. She just wanted it to honor moms and the things that were done by moms, the love shared by moms. And so I think it's a very special day because of that, as we think about Mother's Day. Now, Billy and I, in our efforts to work together to honor the words of the month, these things are so important and so special. And so today, we're thinking about moms, but we're thinking about this passage that Billy talked about last week, loving the Lord your God with all of your heart and soul and mind and strength. And then today, I want to think about loving your neighbor as you love yourself. I don't know if any of you have noticed yet or not, but Christianity is challenging. Life challenges us. When we start thinking about how hard it is to be a Christian, all you got to do is think about events that are going on in our congregation right now. There are numbers of events that are going on in our congregation right now. There are hurt feelings, there are problems, there are things that we look at that we wish weren't here, but guess what? They're here. Research shows and practicality shows us that every relationship has its disagreements. Every relationship. It doesn't matter what it is. I've heard some people say in marriage conversations, my husband and I, or my wife and I, we've never had a fight. Well, you may not have had one overtly, but it's because one of you kept in whatever it was that was bothering you, and you could just explode at any minute because you've never let it out. But there's never been a husband and a wife who didn't have disagreements. And solving those disagreements is something that is so very important and so very needed. Now, you can't have one without the other. Some of you old folks are thinking about love and marriage and horse and carriages, aren't you? As we think about that. But what I want you to think about this morning is you cannot think about loving God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength without loving me. If you think I'm the worst preacher in the world, you still gotta love me. If you think Billy Smith's the worst preacher in the world, you still got to love him. If you think that Bible class teacher that just taught you a Bible class, boy, he needs to go somewhere else and learn to teach, you still got to love him. Whatever it is you're thinking this morning about anybody in this world, you got to love them. You can't have love for God without love for your neighbor. Everything that you and I know about that leads us toward God depends on my love for God, an expression of my love for God. But it also depends on that foundation for my life every day with my fellow man, loving my fellow man. Love yourself. Some people love themselves so much, if you look down at the bottom, I just want to start with what's on the bottom of this slide. Self-love is not and cannot mean self-indulgence. You see, sometimes, boy, I deserve a really big perk in my life. I'm going to go out to eat, and I'm going to go to McDonald's instead of getting quarter pounder, I'm going to get a double quarter pounder. I deserve so much in my life. We start talking and thinking about ourselves and we want to indulge ourselves. I deserve this because I have done that. That's not the kind of love that makes the world what it ought to be. It's not the kind of love that makes the church what it ought to be. When we begin to think about God caring so much about every one of us, He created you in His image. We can image God. We can be as much like God as we develop the spiritual maturity to be. God wants people to see Him living in you. How unbelievable is that? Here is the Son of God who wants people, when they look at your life, to see Him. He cares that much about you. We are created in such a way that we can image and mimic and be like God. Paul said, "You be imitators of me, even as I am also of Christ." That's where we want to be. That's where we need to be. Some of you have those little puppies, I like to say, that you just love. And I know that one or two of you have those little cats that you just love to love. God didn't create that little puppy or that little kitten in God's image. These beautiful little babies that are here all the way to the oldest person in this room, created in the image of God. No other creature is afforded that level of dignity and that place in God's creation. God's love for man is different from every other creature. Jesus did not die on the cross, and God did not send his son into the world to save cats and dogs and elephants. And PETA may have a great place in our culture in helping us appreciate and take care of animals better. But the fact of the matter is, God did not die for any creation other than you and me. We're special. Special in God's sight. And since God loves us so much, that love that he has for us ought to be the foundation for us caring about ourselves. Caring so much that we're not going to be violating God's will and demeaning ourselves, putting ourselves in a position of not being able to go home to be with God. There are children sometimes in this world who live in such ways they can't go home. They just can't go home. The love that their parents shared with them did not become the foundation for them loving themselves sufficiently, to come back and share the love they have for themselves with their parents and their family, because they let self-love become self-indulgence. And it's a sad, tragic circumstance when that happens. We have every right to love ourselves because God loved us. Now, the love for God that we have is the foundation for loving ourselves. And the way in which we choose to love ourselves is the foundation for how we love each other. Now, when God wanted us to know what people in the Old Testament needed to hear and know about what it means to love your neighbor as you love yourself, you know what? I'm going to share a couple of slides with you very quickly here. And I don't see God telling me I have to feel really good about every neighbor that I have. I don't have to feel really good about wrong kinds of behavior if I love my neighbor. But here is what those people under the law had to do if they were going to love their neighbor. They had to not reap the field up to its edge, nor gather the gleanings after the harvest. There would be some stalks of wheat that would fall to the ground. Leave that alone. Don't go all the way to the edge. Don't go all the way to the corner. Leave that alone. When you're gathering grapes, don't strip your vineyard and take every grape off the vine. You leave some for people that are poor and people that are sojourning. They're only in the land for a little while. They don't have anything for themselves. They need your help. So you leave them. You leave them some things. When you're dealing with your neighbor, don't take what belongs to them. Don't deal falsely with your neighbor. Don't lie to or about your neighbor. Don't swear to anyone about God's name falsely. We use God's name so loosely. Sometimes we'll be trying to convince people we're telling the truth, and we'll tell them the truth, and we obviously see they don't believe us. And we'll say, I swear. And then if they still don't believe us, I swear with a hand on a Bible. I swear to God on a stack of Bibles. We just keep asking. It doesn't make any difference, does it? Don't lie. Tell the truth so much that when people talk about your word, they say that your word really is your bond. That's how to love your neighbor. Do not oppress your neighbor in any way or oppress your neighbor. If you have a hired worker, the custom of that day is to pay the hired worker at the end of the day. It wasn't like the economy that we live in. They needed money every day. Don't withhold that. If they hurt your feelings, you pay them anyway. If they don't get exactly everything done that you meant for them to get done, you pay them. Pay the hired worker at the end of the day. I'm coming to appreciate this next statement in a greater way. Don't curse to death. I'm in conversation sometimes and I can't hear very well, and people are saying things. It could be some of the negativest, ugliest, hurtfulest things I could ever hear, if I could hear it. But God says, do not curse the deaf. Don't place a stumbling block in front of someone who can't see that they will stumble over. Don't do injustice in court. Do not be partial just because someone is poor. Nor do you defer to someone just because they are great. Always judge in righteousness regardless of who you're judging, and do not slander among your people. Now, if you transfer those over into the New Testament, which you can, Christianity is not easy, is it? Because there are people that talk about you, that mistreat you, that hurt your feelings. They do so many negative things to you. Translating that into everyday life is tough work. But you know what? You cannot say, I love God, and then fill your life with the wrong kinds of things in behavior toward your neighbor. Look at this. Do not hate your brother in your heart, lest you incur sin because of him. Have you ever seen somebody really hurt and they just lash out trying to show that person, I'm going to get you. I'm going to do something to show you that you are really bad and mean and ugly and hurtful. You've hurt me. You've hurt my family. You've hurt other people. And now you see what's happened to them. The sin has come into their heart. Because Christianity is tough. Loving your neighbor is tough. Do not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And the reason we listen to that, God said, I am the Lord. Not easy. But it's what God said. What does loving one's neighbor look like? You want a really clear picture of it? Go to the cross. But this morning, what I want you to do is, as you go to the cross, if we had a big cross right here as tall as that opening is behind me, and we had the Lord's physical body actually hanging on that cross, dying for you and me, and we were here lashing out, saying, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. You saved others, you can't save yourself. And then both of the thieves on the cross were crying out and railing against him, saying ugly things about him. People would come by and spit on him. He already had the crown of thorns on his head. He already had been nailed to that cross. I don't believe anybody in this world will ever hurt you or me or anyone you know in as bad a way as we hurt the Christ. Because you see, it's my sin that caused him to be on that cross. It's your sin that caused him to be on the cross. My sin cost him his life. I will never hurt anyone, nor will anyone ever hurt me in a way as great as I have hurt the Christ. Look at Jesus on the cross, caring for his mother, telling that apostle that he loved, son, here's your mom. Mom, here's your son. See Jesus saying to that thief that had just been criticizing him and being ugly to him, today you will be with me in paradise. Seeing Jesus cry out to his father, thinking about those people that had nailed him to the cross. They were in the process of continuing to sin against him. And he says, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they do. Now, can we really see Jesus dying for you? Or is it some generic picture in a Bible that has all kinds of pictures? Or is it some image in your mind about Jesus hanging right up there? Or can you really see Jesus dying because you have hurt him so much that without his death, you could never enter God's eternal kingdom. Can you see that? Every sin you and I commit is against God. And if he's willing to love us as he has shown his love, he has a right to ask you and me to love each other, even though we are so unlovely someday. We hurt each other. We behave in ways that destroy homes. We behave in ways that destroy our relationships. We behave in ways that just plain hurt. God has a right to ask you and me to love each other. Jesus said at the end of this passage in Matthew 22 that we had read to us last week and thought about this week, on these two hang all the law and the prophets. It's all about loving God, the basis on which that second part comes, loving each other. Today, if there's a need in your heart to respond to the Lord, the basis for that response is going to be love. You believe in shoes? The city of everywhere tells a story about a man who arrives in a city one cold morning. As he gets off the train, he sees that the station is like every other station except for one thing. Everyone is barefoot. No one wears shoes. He notices a barefoot cab driver. He says, "Pardon me, sir. I was just wondering, why don't you wear shoes? Do you believe in shoes?" The driver says, "Sure we do." The man said, "Why don't you wear them?" "Ah, that is the question," the driver replied. "Why don't we wear shoes? Why don't we?" At the hotel, it's the same. The clerk, the bellboys, everybody is barefoot. In the coffee shop, he notices a nice-looking gentleman at a table opposite him. He says, "I notice you aren't wearing any shoes. I wonder why." "Don't you know about shoes?" the man replied. "Of course I know about shoes. Then why don't you wear them?" "Ah, that's the question. Why don't we? Why don't we?" After breakfast, he walks out on the street in the snow, but every person he sees is barefoot. He asks another man about it and points out how shoes protect the feet from cold. The man says, "We know about shoes. You see that building over there? That's a shoe manufacturing plant. We're proud of that plant, and every week we gather there to hear the man in charge tell us about shoes and about how wonderful they are." "Then why don't you wear shoes?" "Ah, that's the question," says the man. Why don't we believe in loving each other? We know about it. Every week, most of you come together at this place or someplace like this, and we talk about loving each other. But when somebody hurts me, do I become like those people who know about shoes? They even have a shoe factory, and they understand how wonderful shoes are, but they don't wear shoes. Why don't we love God? Why don't we wear shoes of love toward our fellow man? You see, if there's a need for a response today, love for God, love for people that you've hurt, wanting them to know that you've hurt them, wanting them to know you don't want to be like that. You want to be better. You want to be different. If you need to wear the shoes of love today, why don't you put them on? Why don't you respond to the Lord to be baptized into Christ if you need to? Why don't you respond as a child of God who has not been loving toward
God or toward your fellow man. That's the purpose of this song. In a real way, is to encourage you to put on the shoes of love if you need to and respond. Let's stand and let's sing.
Roar in heart, O God.